It was Christmas Eve, 1945. George Sodder, his wife Jenny, and 9 of their 10 children were home in Fayetteville, West Virginia. Their oldest daughter, Marion, had been working at a dime store in downtown Fayetteville that day, and she had surprised 3 of her younger siblings with toys she had bought them as Christmas gifts. The younger children were so excited that they asked their mother if they could stay up past what would have been their usual bedtime. At 10 p.m, Jenny told them they could stay up a little later, as long as the 2 older boys who were still awake, 14-year-old Maurice and his 9-year-old brother Louis, remembered to put the cows in and feed the chickens before going to bed themselves. She then took Sylvia, the youngest, upstairs with her and they went to bed. By a little after 2 a.m, however, their entire house had been ravaged by fire, with only George, Jenny, and 4 of their children able to escape. While on the surface this sounds like a horrific accident, you don't have to look far to find the strange evidence that some sort of foul play may have been involved. George was an Italian immigrant, originally from Sardinia. Fayetteville had a large population of Italian migrants. George's business prospered and his family became one of the most respected middle-class families around. However, George had strong opinions about many subjects and was not shy about expressing them. In particular, his strong opposition to Italian dictator Mussolini led to some heated arguments with other members of the immigrant community. On the 28th of April 1945, during the final days of World War II, Mussolini was executed. George's criticism of the late dictator had left some hard feelings in the area. Just 2 months before the fire, a visiting life insurance salesman warned George that due to his dirty remarks he had been making about Mussolini, his house would go up in smoke and his children were going to be destroyed. A visiting electrician went around to the back of the house and warned George that a pair of fuse boxes would cause a fire someday. George was puzzled by the observation, since he had just had the house rewired when an electric stove was installed, and he contacted the company who did the rewiring. They assured him the work was safe and that the person who made the comments was probably just looking for work. In the few weeks leading up to Christmas, the children also told their parents of a strange car that seemed to be following them back from school on several occasions. Back to Christmas Eve. Before the fire had started, at around 12:30 a.m, the telephone rang. Jenny woke up and went downstairs to answer it. The caller was a woman whose voice she did not recognise, asking for a name she was not familiar with, and with the sound of laughter and clinking glasses in the background. Jenny told the caller she had the wrong number, hung up, and went to return to bed. On her way, she noticed that the lights were still on and the curtains were not drawn, 2 things the children would normally do when they stayed up later than their parents. Marion had fallen asleep on the sofa, so Jenny assumed the other children who had stayed up later had gone back up to the attic where they slept. She closed the curtains, turned off the lights, and went back to bed. At 1 a.m, Jenny was again woken up, this time by the sound of an object hitting the roof of their house with a loud bang, followed by a rolling noise. After hearing nothing further, she went back to sleep. Half an hour later, however, she woke up a third time, this time smelling smoke. Jenny woke George, who then went and woke up their eldest sons, John and George Jr. Jenny took baby Sylvia to safety, waking Marion on the way out of the house. They frantically yelled to the children upstairs, but heard no response. They were unable to go up there as the stairway itself was already on fire. Once outside, George began trying to find ways to save his children from the attic, while Jenny tried to contact the fire department, but this would prove to be more difficult than expected. George ran to find his ladder, which was strangely not in its usual place, despite it being left there the day before. He then tried to move his work trucks alongside the house, with the hopes of climbing on top of them to reach the window, but neither of the trucks would start, which he also claimed were working fine the day before the fire. Jenny, unfortunately, also had similar luck. Their own phone wasn't working, so she ran to a neighbour's house to make a call, but was unable to reach an operator. A driver on the nearby road had also seen the flames and called from a nearby tavern. They too, unfortunately, were unsuccessful, either because they could not reach the operator or because the phone was broken. Eventually, though, somebody was successful in reaching the fire department. Unfortunately, the fire department was low on manpower due to the war, and because they were relying on individual firefighters to call each other, they did not respond to the emergency until 8 a.m., almost 7 hours after the fire had begun. By then, all that remained of the house was ash and debris. Chief F.J. Morris said the next day that the already slow response was further hampered by his inability to drive the fire truck, requiring that he wait until someone who could drive was available. The firefighters, one of whom was a brother of Jenny's, could do little but look through the ashes that were left in the sodder's basement. By 10 a.m, Morris told the sodders that they had not found any bones, but that he believed that the 5 children unaccounted for had died in the fire, suggesting that it had been hot enough to burn their bodies completely. Jenny didn't believe this to be true, so she decided to investigate their disappearance independently. She visited a local crematorium to find out if the fire could have destroyed human bone. An employee told her that human bones remain even after bodies are burnt at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit or 1,090 degrees Celsius for 2 hours, far longer and hotter than the house fire could have been. An official inquest was held, and its finding was that the fire was an accident caused by faulty wiring. Strangely, one of the jurors just happened to be the life insurance salesman who'd threatened George. But the strangeness does not end there. The missing ladder was found 75 feet away from the house, seemingly thrown down an embankment. The phone lines were also later confirmed to have been cut, not burnt in the fire as first thought. A man whom neighbours had seen stealing a block and tackle, a system of 2 or more pulleys with a rope or cable threaded between them, usually used to lift heavy loads, was identified and arrested. He admitted to the theft and claimed that he had been the one who cut the phone line, thinking it was a power line, but denied having anything to do with the fire. However, no record of the suspect's identity exists, and why he would have wanted to cut any utility lines to the Sodder house has never been explained. Jenny said in 1968 that if he had cut the power line, she and her husband, along with their other 4 children, would never have been able to make it out of the house. Evidence also soon emerged indicating that the fire had not started in an electrical fault and was instead set deliberately. The driver of a bus that passed through Fayetteville late Christmas Eve said that he had seen some people throwing balls of fire at the house. A few months later, when the snow had melted, Sylvia found a small, hard, dark green, rubber ball-like object in the brush nearby. George, recalling his wife's account of a loud bang on the roof before the fire, said it looked like a pineapple bomb, hand grenade, or some other incendiary device used in combat. The Christmas lights that were blamed for the blaze also stayed on during the fire, making them unlikely to be the cause. George and Jenny paid for a giant billboard that read, "What was the fate of our children? Kidnapped, murdered, or burned?" They offered a reward of $5,000, which works out at approximately $217,000 today, for any helpful information. the police received many reports following the disappearance of the children, and one witness claimed she served them breakfast a week after the fire. The woman was working at a hotel in Charleston, 50 miles west from the Sodder home. She said the children were accompanied by two women and two men, all of Italian extraction. They registered at about midnight. I tried to talk to the children in a friendly manner, but the men appeared hostile and refused to allow me to talk to these children. One of the men looked at me in a hostile manner. He turned around and began talking rapidly in Italian. Immediately, the whole party stopped talking to me. I sensed that I was being frozen out, and so I said nothing more. They left early the next morning. Other witnesses also claimed to have seen the missing Sodder children. One woman, who had been watching the fire from the road, said she had seen some of them peering out of a passing car while the house was burning. Another woman at a rest stop between Fayetteville and Charleston said that she had served them breakfast the next morning and noted the presence of a car with Florida license plates in the rest stop's parking lot. Unhappy with the findings and lack of investigation, the Sodders hired a private investigator named C.C. Tinsley. He discovered rumours that despite his report to the Sodders that no remains had been found in the ashes, Chief Morris had found a heart which he later packed into a metal box and secretly buried. Morris had apparently confessed this to a local minister, who in turn confirmed it to George. George and Tinsley went to Morris and confronted him with this news. Morris agreed to show the two where he had buried the metal box, and they dug it up. They took what they found inside the box to a local funeral director, who, after examining it, told them it was in reality fresh beef liver that had never been exposed to fire. Later, more rumours circulated around Fayetteville that Morris had afterwards admitted that he had supposedly planted the box there in the hopes that the Sodders would find it and be satisfied that the missing children had indeed died in the fire. In 1947, George and Jenny appealed directly to FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, hoping he would help. They received a personal letter from Hoover, who wrote, "Although I would like to be of service, the matter related appears to be of local character and does not come within the investigative jurisdiction of this bureau." Other FBI agents said they were willing to help the family once they were granted permission from local authorities, but for some reason, the Fayetteville Police and Fire Department refused to give the go-ahead. In August 1949, George was able to persuade Oscar Hunter, a Washington DC pathologist, to supervise a new search through the dirt at the house site. After a very thorough search, artifacts including a dictionary that had belonged to the children and some coins were found. Several small bone fragments were also unearthed, determined to have been human vertebrae. The bone fragments were sent to Marshall T. Newman, a specialist in the Smithsonian Institution. They were confirmed to be lumbar vertebrae, all from the same person, and the age of this individual at death should have been 16 or 17 years. Given this age range, it was not very likely that these bones were from any of the five missing children, since the oldest, Maurice, had been 14 at the time. Newman added that the bone showed no signs of exposure to flame. He also agreed that it was very strange that those bones were the only ones found. The report concluded that the vertebrae had instead most likely come from the dirt that George had used to bulldoze the site when building their memorial garden, but with no explanation as to how they got there. George followed up on leads in person, travelling to the areas from where tips had come. A woman from St. Louis, Missouri, claimed Martha was being held in a convent there. A bar patron in Texas claimed to have overheard two other people making incriminating statements about a fire that happened on Christmas Eve in West Virginia some years before. None of those gave any helpful information. When George heard later that a relative of Jenny's in Florida had children that looked similar to his, the relative had to prove the children were his own before George was satisfied. On another occasion, George saw a magazine photo of a group of young ballet dancers in New York City, one of whom looked like his missing daughter Betty. He drove all the way to the girl's school, where his repeated demands to see the girl himself were refused. In 1967, George went to the Houston area to investigate another tip. A woman there had written to the family saying that Louis had revealed his true identity to her one night after having too much to drink. She believed that he and Maurice were both living in Texas somewhere. However, George and his son-in-law, Grover Paxton, were unable to speak with her. Police there were unable to help them find the two men she had indicated, but they denied being the missing sons. Paxton said years later that doubts about that denial lingered in George's mind for the rest of his life. Another letter that they received that year brought the Sodders what they believed was the most credible evidence that at least Louis was still alive. One day, Jenny found a letter addressed to her in the mail, postmarked from Central City, Kentucky, with no return address. Inside was a picture of a young man, aged around 30, with features strongly resembling Louis, who would have been in his 30s if he had survived. The family hired another private detective to go to Central City and look into this, but were unable to locate him. The picture, nonetheless, gave them hope. They added it to the billboard and put an enlargement of it over their fireplace. George Sodder died in 1969, Jenny in 1989. The surviving Sodder children, joined by their own children, continued to publicise the case and investigate leads. They, along with the older Fayetteville residents, have theorised that the Sicilian Mafia was trying to extort money from George, and the children may have been taken by someone who knew about the planned arson and said they would be safe if they left the house. Some also believe they were possibly taken back to Italy. If the children had survived all those years and were aware that their parents and siblings had survived too, the family believes they may have avoided contact in order to keep them from harm. Sylvia Sodder Paxton, the youngest survivor of the Sodder home fire, died in 2021. But the question of what happened to her five siblings still lives on today.